out there for me. Maybe a whole new song. Some Pink Floyd for a change. Hollow laughter in marble halls. I smiled in the darkness, listening to the rhythmic sound of her breathing until it softened into sleep. I was exhausted. Even though we were back in the mortal world, it still felt as if I was part of the Castor world, and Gatlin was unbelievably far away. I couldn't make sense of how I had gotten to this place any more than I could measure the miles I had come or the distance I still had to go. I drifted into oblivion, not knowing what I would do when I got there. June 19th. Bonaventure. I was running, being chased, scrambling over hedges and skidding across empty streets and backyards. The one constant was the adrenaline. There was no stopping. Then I saw the Harley, driving straight at me, the lights getting closer and closer. They weren't yellow, but green, flashing in my eyes so bright I had to cover my face with my hands. I woke up. All I could see was green, flashing on and off. I didn't know where I was until I realized the green glow was coming from the arc light, now lit up like the 4th of July. It was on the mattress, or it must have rolled out of my pocket. Only the mattress looked different, and the light was flashing out of control. I remembered slowly the stars, the tunnels, the attic, the guest room. Then I realized why the mattress looked different. Liv was gone. It didn't take long to figure out where Liv was. "Do you ever sleep?" "Not as much as you do, apparently." As usual, Liv didn't look up from her telescope, though this one was aluminum and much smaller than the one she kept on Marion's porch. I sat down next to her on the back step. The yard was as calm as my aunt herself, a quiet patch of green spreading underneath a broad magnolia tree. "What are you doing up?" "I got a wake-up call." I tried to sound casual instead of how I actually felt. Awkward. I motioned at the guest room window on the second floor. Even from down here, you could see pulsing green light shining through the glass panes. "Strange. I suppose I got one as well. Take a look through the Celestron." She handed me the miniature scope. It looked like a flashlight except for the large lens fitted to one end. Our hands touched as I took it. Not so much as a shock.
"Did you make this too?"
She smiled. "Professor Ashcroft gave it to me. Now stop talking and look. There." She pointed right over the magnolia, which to my mortal eye looked like a dark expanse of starless sky. I fitted the scope to my eye. Now the sky over the tree was streaked with light, a kind of ghostly aura trailing toward the ground not far from us.
"What is that? A falling star? Do falling stars leave trails like that?"
"It might, if it was a falling star."
"How do you know it's not?"
She tapped the scope. "It might be falling, but it's a Castor star falling in the Castor sky, remember? Otherwise we would see it without the scope."
"Is that what your crazy watch is saying?"
She picked it up from the step next to her. "I'm not sure what it's saying. I thought it was broken until I saw the sky." The arc light was still flashing in the window, a constant green strobe light. I remembered something from my dream. It felt as if the Harley was headed right at me.
"We can't stay here. Something's happening. Something here in Savannah."
Liv strapped her selenometer back onto her wrist. "Whatever it is seems to be happening over there." She dropped the scope into her backpack and pointed into the distance. It was time to go. I held out my hand, but she pulled herself to her feet. "You wake up, Link. I'll get my things."
"I still don't see why this couldn't wait until morning," Link was grouchy, and his spiky hair was sticking up everywhere. "Does this thing look like it could wait until morning?" The arc light was so bright now, it lit up the whole street in front of us.
"Can you put it on a lower setting or something? Switch off the high beams already."
Link shielded his eyes.
"I don't think it's working."
I shook the arc light, but the flashing green light didn't stop.
"Man, you broke the magic eight ball."
"I didn't break it.
I gave up, jamming it into my pocket.
"Yeah, it's pretty much broken."
The light was shining through my jeans.
"It's possible some sort of caster power surge triggered it and shifted the normal balance of how the arc light functions."
Liv was intrigued. Link wasn't.
"Like an alarm? That's not good."
"We don't know that."
"Are you kidding? It's never good when Commissioner Gordon activates the bat signal, when the Fantastic Four see the number 4 in the sky."
I get the idea.
"Yeah? Can you get one that gets us where we're trying to go, since Ethan broke the eight ball?"
Liv consulted her selenometer and started walking.
"I can get us to the general area where the star fell."
She looked at me.
"I mean, if it was a star. But Link might be right. I don't know exactly where we're going, or what we'll find when we get there."
"Almost makes a guy wish he had his own pair of garden shears," I said, following Liv down the street.
"Speaking of things that aren't normal, look who's here."
Link pointed to the curb in front of a house with red shutters. Lucille was sitting on the edge of the sidewalk, staring at us as if we were holding her up.
"Told you she'd come back."
Lucille licked her brown paws sulkily, waiting.
"Couldn't live without me, could you, girl? I have that effect on women."
Link grinned, scratching her head. She batted his fingers away.
"Come on now, aren't you coming?"
Lucille didn't budge.
"Yep, he's got that effect on women," I said to Liv as Lucille stretched out in front of the house.
"She'll come around," Link said. "They always do."
That's when Lucille took off running down the street in the opposite direction from the way we went. It was the middle of the night and pitch dark by the time we found ourselves heading out of town. It felt like we had been walking for hours. The main road was always busy during the day. Now it was deserted, which made sense, considering where it had led us.
"You sure about this?"
"Not at all. It's only an approximation based on the available data."
Liv had been checking her little telescope about every 5 blocks. There was no doubting the data.
"I love it when she talks nerdy."
Link pulled on her braid and Liv batted him away. I stared at the tall stone columns flanking the entrance to Savannah's famed Bonaventure Cemetery on the outskirts of town. It was one of the most famous cemeteries in the South and one of the most well-protected, which was a problem since it had closed at dusk.
"Dude, this is a joke, right? Are you guys sure this is where we're supposed to be?"
Link didn't look too happy about wandering around the cemetery at night, especially with a guard at the entrance and a patrol car that passed by the front gates every so often. Liv looked up at a statue of a woman clinging to a cross.
"Let's get this over with."
Link pulled out his garden shears.
"I don't think these babies will do the job."
"Not through the gates," I pointed at the wall on the other side of the trees. "Over them."
Liv managed to step on every part of my face, kick me in the neck, and wrench her sneakers deep into my shoulder blade before I shoved all 6 pounds of her over the gate. She lost her balance at the top and landed with a thump.
"I'm fine, no worries,"
Liv called from the other side of the wall. Link and I looked at each other and he bent down.
"You first, I'll climb up the hard way."
I stepped on his back, grabbing onto the wall.
He pushed himself up until he was standing. Yeah? How are you gonna do that? Gotta look for a tree that's close enough to the wall. Has to be one somewhere around here. Don't worry. I'll find you.
I was at the top. I clung to the wall with both hands.
I didn't ditch school all these years for nothing.
I smiled and let myself fall. Five minutes and seven trees later, the arc light led us deeper into the cemetery, past the crumbling Confederate headstones and the statues guarding the homes of those who had been forgotten. There was a tight cluster of moss-covered oaks whose crossed branches created an arch over the path, barely wide enough to squeeze through. The arc light was flashing and pulsing.
We're here. This is it, right?
I looked over Liv's shoulder at the selenometer. Link looked around.
Where? I don't see anything.
I pointed to space between the trees.
Seriously?
Liv looked nervous, too. She didn't want to climb through brambles of Spanish moss in a dark graveyard.
I can't get a reading now. It's going crazy.
It doesn't matter. This is it, I'm sure. You think Lena and Ridley and John are back there?
Link looked like he was planning to go back and wait for us out front, or maybe at a rib joint.
I don't know.
I pushed the moss aside and stepped through. On the other side, the trees were even more ominous, hanging over our heads and creating a sky of their own. There was a clearing ahead of us, with a huge statue of a beseeching angel in the center of the graves. The graves were bordered in stone, outlining the breadth of each plot. You could almost see the coffins buried in the earth beneath them.
Ethan, look!
Liv pointed past the statue. I could see silhouettes framed by a tiny slice of moonlight. They were moving.
We had company.
Link shook his head.
This can't be good.
For a second, I couldn't move. What if it was Lena and John? What were they doing in a graveyard at night, alone? I followed the path, flanked by even more statues, kneeling angels staring into the heavens, or the ones looking down at us as they wept. I had no idea what to expect, but when the two figures came into view, they were the last two people I expected to see. Amma and Aurelia, Macon's mother. The last time I'd seen her was at Macon's funeral. They were sitting between the graves. I was a dead man. I should have known Amma would find me. There was another woman sitting in the dirt with them. I didn't recognize her. She was a little older than Aurelia, with the same golden skin. Her hair was woven in hundreds of tiny braids, and she was wearing 20 or 30 strands of beads, some gemstones and colored glass, others tiny birds and animals. She had at least 10 holes winding around each ear, and long earrings hung from each hole. The three of them were sitting cross-legged in a circle, headstones dotting the dirt around them. Their hands were joined in the center of the circle. Amma had her back to us, but I had no doubt she knew I was there.
It took you long enough. We've been waiting, and you know how I hate to wait.
Amma's voice was no more agitated than usual, which didn't make any sense since I had disappeared without even a note.
Amma, I'm really sorry.
She waved her hand as if she was swatting a fly.
No time for that now.
Amma shook the bone in her hand, a graveyard bone, I was willing to bet. I looked at Amma.
Did you bring us here? Can't say I did. Something else brought you. Something stronger than me. I just knew you were coming.
How? Amma gave me some of her best stink eye.
How does a bird know to fly south? How does a catfish know how to swim? I don't know how many times I have to tell you, Ethan Waite. They don't call me a seer for nothing.
I foresaw your arrival, too.
Aurelia was stating a fact, but it annoyed Amma just the same. I could tell by the look on her face. Amma raised her chin.
After I mentioned it.
Amma was used to being the only seer in Gatlin, and she didn't like being trumped, even if it was by a diviner with supernatural gifts. The other woman, the one I didn't know, turned to Amma.
We best get started, Amari. They're waiting.
Come sit down here,
Amma motioned to us.
Twyla's ready.
Twyla. I recognized the name. Aurelia answered the question before I asked.
This is my sister, Twyla. She's come a long way to be with us here tonight.
I remembered. Lena had mentioned her great-aunt Twyla, the one who had never left New Orleans. Until now.
That's right. Now you come on sit by me, Cher. Don't be afraid. It's only a circle of sight.
Twyla patted the space next to her. Amma was sitting on Twyla's other side, giving me the look. Liv stepped back, looking pretty freaked out, even if she was training to be a keeper. Link stayed right behind her. Amma had that effect on people, and from the looks of things, Twyla and Aurelia did too.
My sister is a powerful necromancer.
Aurelia's voice was proud. Link made a face and whispered to Liv,
She gets with dead people? That's the kind of thing a person should keep to themselves.
Liv rolled her eyes.
Not a necrophiliac, stupid. A necromancer. A caster capable of calling and communicating with the dead.
Aurelia nodded.
That's right. And we need help from someone who's already left this world.
I knew right away who she was talking about, or at least I hoped I did.
Amma, are we trying to call Macon?
Sadness passed across her face.
I wish I could say we were, but wherever Melchizedek's gone, we can't go. It's time.
Twyla pulled something out of her pocket and looked at Amma and Aurelia. You could feel the shift in their demeanor. The three of them were all business now, even if it was the business of waking the dead. Aurelia opened her hands in front of her lips and spoke softly into them.
My power is your power, sisters.
She tossed tiny stones into the center of the circle.
Moonstones, Liv whispered.
Amma pulled out a sack of chicken bones. I would know that smell anywhere. It was the smell of my kitchen back home.
My power's your power, sisters.
Amma tossed the bones into the circle with the moonstones. Twyla opened her own hand, revealing a tiny carving in the shape of a bird. She spoke the words that gave it power.
One unto this world, one unto the next. Open the door to the one who's annexed.
She started to chant, loud and feverish, the unfamiliar words rippling through the air. Her eyes rolled back in her head, but her eyelids remained open. Aurelia began to chant as well, shaking long strands of tasseled beads. Amma grabbed my chin so she could look me in the eye.
I know this isn't going to be easy, but there are things you need to know.
The air in the center of the circle of sight began to swirl and churn, creating a thin white mist. Twyla, Aurelia, and Amma continued to chant, their voices reaching a crescendo. The mist seemed to act on their command, gaining speed and density, swirling upward like a growing tornado. Without warning, Twyla inhaled sharply, as if she was taking her last breath. The mist seemed to follow, disappearing into her mouth. For a minute, I thought she was going to drop dead. She sat there, her back so straight you would have thought she was tied to a rack, eyes rolled back in her head, mouth still open. Link retreated to a safe distance, while Liv scrambled forward to help, reaching for Twyla. But Amma grabbed her arm in midair.
Wait.
Twyla exhaled. The white mist raced from her lips, rising over the circle,
taking form. The mist swirled upward, creating a body as it moved. The bare feet peeking out beneath a white dress, the torso filling the dress as if inflating a balloon. It was a sheer, rising from the haze. I watched as the mist snaked upward, creating a torso, a delicate neck, and finally, a face. It was my mother. Staring back at me with the same luminous, ethereal quality unique to Shears. But beyond the translucence, she looked exactly like my mother. Her eyelids fluttered, and she looked at me. The Shear didn't just look like my mother. It was my mother. She spoke, and her voice was as soft and melodic as I remembered.
"Ethan, sweetheart, I've been waiting for you."
I stared at her, speechless. In every dream I'd had of her since the day she died, every photograph, every memory, she was never as real as this.
"There is so much I need to tell you, so much I can't say. I've tried to show you the way, send you the songs."
She sent me the songs. The songs only Lena and I could hear. I spoke, but my voice sounded far away, as if it wasn't my own. 17 Moons, the shadowing song. "It was you, this whole time." She smiled.
"Yes, you needed me. But now he needs you, and you need him too."
"Who? Are you talking about Dad?" But I knew she wasn't talking about my father. She was talking about the other man who meant so much to both of us. Macon. She didn't know he was gone. "Are you talking about Macon?" I saw a spark of recognition in her eyes. I had to tell her. If something had happened to Lena, I would want someone to tell me, no matter how much everything changed. "Macon's gone, Mom. He died a few months ago. He can't help me." I watched her shimmer in the moonlight. She was as beautiful as the last time I saw her, when she hugged me on the rainy porch before I left for school.
"Listen to me, Ethan. He'll always be with you. Only you can redeem him."
Her image began to fade. I reached out desperate to touch her, but my hand only slipped through the air. "Mom?"
"The claiming moon has been called."
She was disappearing, vanishing into the night.
"If darkness prevails, the 17th moon will be the last."
I almost couldn't see her anymore. The mist was swirling slowly again above the circle.
"Hurry, Ethan. You don't have much time, but you can do this. I have faith."
She smiled, and I tried to memorize her expression because I knew she was slipping away. "What if I'm too late?" I could hear her distant voice.
"I tried to keep you safe. I should have known I couldn't. You were always special."
I stared at the white haze, churning like my stomach.
"My sweet summer boy, I'll be thinking of you. I love..."
The words dwindled into nothing. My mom had been here. For a few minutes, I had seen her smile and heard her voice. Now she was gone. I had lost her all over again. "I love you too, Mom." June 19th. Scars.
"There's something I've got to tell you."
Amma wrung her hands nervously.
"It's about the night of the 16th moon, Lena's birthday."
Took a second to realize she was talking to me. I was still staring into the center of the circle where my mother had been a moment before. This time my mom wasn't sending me messages in books or the verses of a song. I had seen her.
"Tell da boy." "Hush, Twyla."
Aurelia put her hand on her sister's arm.
Lies. Lies are the place where darkness grows. You tell the boy. Tell him now.
What are you talking about? I looked from Twyla to Aurelia. Amma shot them a look that Twyla answered with a shake of her beaded braids.
Listen to me, Ethan Waite.
Amma's voice was uneven and shaky.
You didn't fall from the top of the crypt. At least, not the way we told you.
What? She wasn't making any sense. Why was she talking about Lena's birthday after I had just seen the ghost of my dead mother?
You didn't fall, see?
She repeated.
What are you talking about? Of course I fell. I woke up on the ground, flat on my back. That's not how you got there.
Amma hesitated.
It was Lena's mama. Seraphine stabbed you with a knife.
Amma looked right into my eyes.
She killed you. You were dead. And we brought you back.
She killed you. I repeated the words to myself, the pieces snapping together so fast I could barely make sense of them. Instead, they made sense of me. The dream that wasn't a dream, but a memory of not breathing and not feeling and not thinking and not seeing. The dirt and flames that carried my body away as my life flowed out.
Ethan, you all right?
I could hear Amma, but she was far away, as far as she was that night when I was on the ground. I could be in the ground now, like my mom and Macon. I should be.
Ethan?
Link was shaking me. My body filled with sensations I couldn't control and didn't want to remember. Blood in my mouth, blood roaring into my ears.
He's passing out!
Liv was holding my head. There had been pain and noise and something else.
Voices, shapes, people. I had died.
I reached under my shirt, running my hand over the scar on my stomach, the scar from where Seraphine had stabbed me with a real knife. I barely noticed it anymore, but now it would be a constant reminder of the night I died. I remembered how Lena reacted when she saw it.
You're still the same person, and Lena still loves you. Her love is the reason you're here now.
Aurelia's voice was gentle, knowing. I opened my eyes, letting the blur of shapes become people as I settled back into myself again. My thoughts were so jumbled, even now nothing was making any sense.
What do you mean her love is the reason I'm here now?
Amma spoke quietly, and I had to strain to hear her.
Lena's the one who brought you back. I helped her. Me and your mama.
The words didn't fit together, so I tried unrolling them out again for myself. Lena and Amma brought me back from the dead, together, and together they had kept it from me until now. I rubbed the scar on my skin. It felt like the truth.
Since when does Lena know how to raise the dead? If she did, don't you think she would have brought Macon back by now?
Amma looked at me. I had never seen her so scared.
She didn't do it on her own. She used the binding spell from the Book of Moons. Binds death to life.
Lena had used the Book of Moons. The book that had cursed Genevieve and Lena's whole family for generations, claiming all the children in Lena's family for light or dark on their 16th birthdays. The book Genevieve had used to bring Ethan Carter Waite back from the dead for only a second, an act she spent the rest of her life paying for. I couldn't think. My mind started caving in on itself again, and I couldn't follow my own thoughts.
Genevieve, Lena, the price. How could you?
I pushed myself away from them, out of their circle of sight. I'd seen enough.
I didn't have a choice. She couldn't let you go.
Amma looked at me, ashamed. I couldn't either. I scrambled to my feet, shaking my head. It's a lie. She wouldn't do it. But I knew she would. They both would. It was exactly what they would have done. I knew, because I would have done it too. It didn't matter now. In my whole life, I had never been so angry with Amma or so disappointed. You knew the book wouldn't give anything without taking something in return. You told me that yourself. I know. Lena will have to pay a price for this, because of me. You both will. My head felt like it was going to split in half or explode. A renegade tear caught on Amma's cheek. She put two fingers on her forehead and closed her eyes, Amma's version of making the sign of the cross, a silent prayer. She's paying it, right now. I couldn't breathe. Lena's eyes, the stunt at the fair, running away with John Breed, the words found their way out even as I tried to hold them in. She's going dark because of me. If Lena's going dark, it's not because of that book. The book made a different kind of trade. Amma stopped, as if she couldn't bear to tell me the rest. What kind of trade? It gave one life, but took another. We knew there'd be consequences. The words caught in her throat. We just didn't know. It would be Melchizedek. Macon. It couldn't be true. It gave one life, but took another. A different kind of trade. My life. For Macon's. It all made sense. The way Lena had been acting the past few months. The way she had been pulling away from me. From everyone. The way she had been blaming herself for Macon's death. It was true. She had killed him. To save me. I thought about her notebook and the charmed page I'd found. What had the words said? Amma, Seraphine, Macon, the book? It was the real story of that night. I remembered the poems written on her wall. Nobody the dead and nobody the living. Two sides of the same coin. Macon. And me. Nothing green can stay. Months ago, I believed she'd gotten the Frost poem wrong, but of course, she hadn't. She was talking about herself. I thought about how it seemed painful for her to look at me. No wonder she felt guilty. No wonder she ran. I wondered if she could ever stand to look at me again. Lena had done it all because of me. It wasn't her fault. It was mine. No one said anything. There was no turning back now, not for any of us. What Lena and Amma had done that night couldn't be undone. I shouldn't be here, but I was. It's the order, and you can't stop the order. Twyla closed her eyes as if she could hear something I couldn't. Amma pulled a handkerchief from her pocket and wiped her face. I'm sorry I didn't tell you, but I'm not sorry we did it. It was the only way. You don't understand. Lena thinks she's going dark. She ran away with some kind of dark caster or incubus. She's in danger because of me. Nonsense. That girl did what she had to do because she loves you. Aurelia collected their offerings from the ground, the bones, the sparrow, the moonstones. Nothing can make Lena go dark, Ethan. She has to choose it. But she thinks she's dark because she killed Macon. She thinks she's already chosen. But she hasn't, Liv said. She was standing a few feet away to give us some privacy. Link was sitting on an old stone bench a few steps behind her.
Then we have to find her and tell her.
He didn't act like he just found out that I'd died and been brought back to life. He acted like everything was the same. I went over and sat down on the bench next to Link. Liv looked over at me.
Are you all right?
Liv. I couldn't look at her. I'd been jealous and hurt, and I had dragged Liv into the middle of my own broken mess of a life, all because I thought Lena didn't love me anymore. But I was stupid, and I was wrong. Lena loved me so much, she was willing to risk everything to save me. I had given up on Lena, after she had refused to give up on me. I owed her my life. It was as simple as that. My fingers touched something carved into the edge of the bench. Words. In the cool, cool, cool of the evening. It was the song that was playing at Ravenwood the first night I met Macon. The coincidence was too much, especially for a world with no coincidences. It had to be some kind of sign. Sign of what? What I had done to Macon? I couldn't even think about how Lena must have felt, realizing she had lost him in my place. What if I had lost my mom that way? Would I have been able to look at Lena alive without seeing my mother dead? Just a minute. I pushed off the bench and took off down the path through the trees, the way we had come. I breathed the night air deep into my lungs, because I could still breathe. When I finally stopped running, I stared up at the stars and the sky. Was Lena staring at the same sky, or one I could never see? Were our moons really so different? I reached into my pocket for the arc light so it could show me how to find her, but it didn't. Instead, it showed me something else.
Macon had never been like his father, Silas, and they both knew it. He had always been more like his mother, Aurelia, a powerful light caster who his father had fallen deeply in love with while he was away at college in New Orleans. Not unlike the way he and Jane had met and fallen in love when he was studying at Duke. And like Macon, his father had fallen in love with his mother before the transformation, before his grandfather had convinced Silas a relationship with a light caster was an abomination against their kind. It had taken Macon's grandfather years to tear his mother and father apart. By that time, he and Hunting and Leah were born. His mother had been forced to use her powers as a diviner to escape Silas's rage and his uncontrollable urge to feed. She had fled to New Orleans with Leah. His father would never have let her take his sons. His mother was the only one Macon could turn to now, the only one who would understand that he had fallen in love with a mortal. The greatest act of sacrilege against his kind, the Blood Incubus, the Demon Soldier. Macon hadn't told his mother he was coming, but she would be expecting him. He climbed up from the tunnels into the sweet heat of a New Orleans summer night. Fireflies blinked in the darkness, and the smell of magnolias was overpowering. She was waiting for him on the porch, tatting lace in an old wooden rocking chair. It had been a long time. "Mama, I need your help." She put down her needle and hoop and rose from the chair.
"I know. Everything's ready, Cher."
There was only one thing powerful enough to stop an incubus, aside from one of its own kind. An arc light. They were considered medieval devices, weapons created to control and imprison the most powerful of the harmers, the incubus. Macon had never seen one before. There were very few left, and they were almost impossible to find. But his mother had one, and he needed it. Macon followed her into the kitchen. She opened a small cabinet that served as an altar to the spirits. She unwrapped a small wooden box with Nyadic script, the ancient caster language, around the perimeter. The one who seeks it shall find it. The house of the unholy, the key to the truth. Your father gave this to me before the transformation. It was passed down in the Ravenwood family for generations. Your granddaddy claimed it belonged to Abraham himself, and I believe it did. It's marked by his hatred and bigotry. She opened the box, revealing the ebony sphere. Macon could feel the energy, even without touching it, the grisly possibility of an eternity within its glistening walls. Macon, you must understand. Once an incubus is trapped inside the arc light, there is no way out from within. You must be released. If you give this to someone, you have to be sure with all certainty that you can trust them, because you will be putting more than your life in their hands. You will be giving them 1,000 lives. That's what an eternity would feel like in there. She held the box higher so he could see it, as if he could imagine the confines just by looking at it. I understand, Mama. I can trust Jane. She's the most honest and principled person I've ever met, and she loves me, despite what I am. Aurelia touched Macon's cheek. There is nothing wrong with who you are, Cher. If there were, it would be my fault. I doomed you to this fate. Macon bent down and kissed her forehead. I love you, Mama. None of this is your fault. It's his. His father. Silas was possibly a greater threat to Jane than he was. His father was a slave to the doctrine of the first Ravenwood blood incubus, Abraham. It's not his fault, Macon. You don't know what your grandfather was like, how he bullied your father into believing his twisted brand of superiority, that mortals were beneath casters and incubuses alike, simply a source of blood to satisfy their lust. Your father was indoctrinated, like his father before him. Macon didn't care. He stopped feeling sorry for his father long ago, stopped wondering what it was about Silas his mother could have loved. Tell me how to use it. Macon reached out tentatively. Can I touch it? Yes. The person who touches you with it must have intent, and even then it's harmless without the carmen defixionis of Laques. His mother removed a small pouch, a gris-gris bag, the strongest protection voodoo could offer, from the door of the cellar and disappeared down the dark stairs. When she returned, she was carrying something wrapped in a dusty piece of burlap. She laid it on the table and unwrapped it. The responsum. Literally translated, it meant the answer. It was written in Nyadic. It contained all the laws that governed his kind. It was the oldest of books. There were only a few copies in the world. His mother turned the brittle pages carefully until she reached the right one. Carcare. The prison. The sketch of the arc light looked exactly like the one resting in the velvet-lined box sitting on his mother's kitchen table, next to her uneaten étouffée. How does it work? It's rather simple. A person need only touch the arc light and the incubus they wish to imprison and speak the carmen at the same moment. The arc light will do the rest. Is the carmen in the book? No. It's much too powerful to be trusted to the written word. You must learn the carmen from someone who knows it and commit it to memory. She lowered her voice as if she was afraid someone might be listening. Then she whispered the words that could condemn him to an eternity of misery. Comprehende, liga, crucifige. Capture, cage, and crucify. Aurelia closed the lid of the box and handed it to Macon. Be
Be careful. In the Ark there is power, and in the power there is night. Macon kissed her forehead. I promise. He turned to leave, but his mother's voice called him back. You'll need this. She scrawled several lines on a piece of parchment. What's this? The only key to that door. She gestured to the box tucked under his arm. The only way to get you back out.
I opened my eyes. I was on my back in the dirt, staring up at the stars. The arc light was Macon's, as Marion had said. I didn't know where he was, the other world or some kind of caster heaven. I didn't know why he was showing me all this, but if I had learned anything tonight, I knew everything happened for a reason. I had to figure out the reason before it was too late. We were still standing in Bonaventure Cemetery, although now we were near the entrance. I didn't bother to tell Amma I wasn't coming back with her. She seemed to know. We better take off. I hugged Amma. She grabbed my hands and gave them a squeeze, hard.
One step at a time, Ethan Waite. Your mama may say this is something you have to do, but I'll be watching every step of the way.
I knew how hard it was for her to let me go, instead of grounding me and sending me straight to my room for the rest of my life. Things were as bad as they seemed. This was proof. Aurelia stepped forward and pressed something into my hand, a small doll like the ones Amma made. It was a voodoo charm.
I had faith in your mother, and I have faith in you, Ethan. This is my way of saying good luck, because this isn't going to be easy.
The right thing and the easy thing are never the same. I repeated the words my mother had said to me 100 times. I was channeling her, in my own way. Twyla touched my cheek with her bony finger.
The truth in both the words, have to lose to gain. We are not here long, Cher.
It was a warning, almost like she knew something I didn't. After what I'd seen tonight, I was sure she did. Amma threw her skinny arms around me in one last bone-crushing hug.
I'm gonna make you some luck, my way, she whispered, and turned to Link. Wesley Jefferson Lincoln, you best come back in one piece, or I'll tell your mama what you were doing in my basement when you were 9 years old. You hear me?
Link smiled at the familiar threat.
Yes, ma'am.
Amma didn't say anything to Liv, just a quick nod in her direction. It was her way of showing where her loyalties lay. Now that I knew what Lena had done for me, I had no doubt about how Amma felt about her. Amma cleared her throat.
The gods are gone, but Twyla can't hold them off forever. You'd best get on.
I pushed open the wrought iron gate with Link, Liv and Lucille behind me.
I'm coming, El. Whether you want me to or not.
June 19th. Down below. Nobody said a word as we walked along the edge of the road toward the park and the Savannah Doorwell. We decided not to risk going back to Aunt Caroline's, since Aunt Dell would be there and wasn't likely to let us keep going without her. Beyond that, there didn't seem to be anything worth saying. Link tried to get his hair to stick up without the aid of industrial-strength hair gel, and Liv checked her selenometer and scribbled in her tiny red notebook once or twice. The same old things. Only the same old things weren't the same this morning. In the gloomy darkness before dawn, my mind was reeling, and I stumbled more than a few times. This night was worse than a nightmare. I couldn't wake up.
I didn't even have to shut my eyes to see the dream, Seraphine and the knife, Lena crying out for me. I had died. I was dead for who knows how long. Minutes? Hours? If it wasn't for Lena, I would be lying in the dirt in his garden of perpetual peace right now, the second sealed cedar box in our family plot. Had I felt things? Seen things? Had it changed me? I touched the hard line of the scar beneath my shirt. Was it really my scar? Or was it the memory of something that happened to the other Ethan Waite? The one who didn't come back? It was all a confusing blur, like the dreams Lena and I shared, or the difference between the two skies Liv had shown me the night the Southern Star disappeared. Which part was real? Had I unconsciously known what Lena had done? Had I sensed it somewhere below everything else that had happened between us? If she had known what she was choosing, would she have chosen differently? I owed my life to her, but I didn't feel happy. All I felt was brokenness. The fear of dirt and nothingness and being alone. The loss of my mom and Macon and, in a way, Lena. And something else. The crippling sadness and the incredible guilt of being the one who lived. Forsyth Park was eerie at dawn. I had never seen it when it wasn't teeming with people. Without them, I almost didn't recognize the door to the tunnels. No trolley bells, no sightseers, no miniature dogs or gardeners trimming azaleas. I thought of all the living, breathing people who would wander through the park today. "You didn't see it," Liv pulled on my arm. "What?" "The door. You walked right by it." She was right. We had walked past the archway before I recognized it. I almost forgot how subtly the Castor world worked, always hidden in plain sight. You couldn't have seen the outer door in the park unless you were looking for it, and the archway kept it in perpetual shadow, probably a cast of its own. Link went to work, ratcheting his shears into the crack between the door and the frame as quickly as possible, prying it open with a groan. The dim recesses of the tunnel were even darker than the summer dawn. "I can't believe that works," I shook my head.
"I've been thinking about it since we left Gatlin," Liv said. "I think it makes loads of sense."
"It makes sense that a crappy pair of garden shears can open a Castor door?"
"That's the beauty of the order of things. I told you, there's the magical universe and the material universe."
Liv stared up at the sky. My eyes followed hers.
"Like the two skies."
"Exactly. One isn't any more real than the other. They coexist."
"So rusty metal scissors can take on a magic portal?" I don't know why I was surprised.
"Not always, but where the two universes meet, there will always be some sort of seam, right?"
It made perfect sense to Liv. I nodded.
"I wonder if a strength in one universe corresponds to a weakness in the other."
She was talking to herself as much as to me. "You mean the door is easy for Link to open because it's impossible for a Castor?"
Link had been having a suspiciously easy time with the Dorwells. On the other hand, Liv didn't know Link had been picking locks since his mom gave him his first curfew in about sixth grade.
"Possibly. It might account for what's happening with the arc light."
"Or what about this? The Castor doors keep on opening because I'm a raging stud," Link flexed. "Or the Castors who built these tunnels hundreds of years ago weren't thinking about garden shears," I said. "Because they were thinking about my extreme studliness in both universes."
He stuck the shears back in his belt.
"Ladies first."
Liv climbed down into the tunnel.
"As if I should be surprised."
We followed the stairs back down into the still air of the tunnel. It was completely quiet, without even an echo from our footsteps. The silence settled over us, thick and heavy. The air beneath the mortal world had none of the weightlessness of the air above. At the bottom of the doorwell, we found ourselves facing the same dark road that had led us to Savannah, the one that had split into two directions, the forbidding, shadowy street we were on, and the meadow path suffused with light. Directly in front of us, the old neon motel sign was flickering on and off now, but that was the only difference. That, and Lucille lying rolled up beneath it, the light hitting her fur as it blinked. She yawned to see us, slowly pulling herself up, one paw at a time.
"You're getting to be a tease, Lucille."
Link squatted on his heels to scratch her ears. Lucille meowed, or growled, depending on how you looked at it.
"Aw, I forgive you."
Everything was a compliment to Link. "What now?" I faced the crossroads.
"Stairway to Hell or the Yellow Brick Road? Why don't you give your eight ball a shake and see if it's ready to play again?"
Link stood up. I took the arc light out of my pocket. It was still glowing, flashing on and off, but the emerald color that led us to Savannah was gone. Now it had turned a deep blue, like one of those satellite photos of the Earth. Liv touched the sphere, the color deepening under her fingertip.
"The blue is so much more intense than the green. I think it's getting stronger."
"Or your superpowers are getting stronger."
Link gave me a shove, and I almost dropped the arc light.
"And you wonder why this thing stopped working?"
I pulled it away from him, annoyed. Link checked me with his shoulder.
"Try to read my mind. Wait. No. Try to fly."
"Stop messing around," Liv snapped. "You heard Ethan's mom. We don't have much time. The arc light will work or it won't. Either way, we need an answer."
Link straightened up. The weight of what we had seen at the graveyard was on all our shoulders now. The strain was beginning to show.
"Shh. Listen."
I took a few steps forward in the direction of the tunnel carpeted in tall grass. You could actually hear the birds chirping now. I raised the arc light and held my breath. I wouldn't have minded if it went black and sent us down the other path, the one with the shadows, the rusty fire escapes crawling down the sides of dark buildings, the unmarked doors, as long as it gave us an answer.
"Not this time."
"Try the other way,"
Liv said, never taking her eyes off the light. I retraced my steps.
No change.
No arc light and no wayward. Because deep down I knew that without the arc light, I wouldn't have been able to find my way out of a paper bag, especially not in the tunnels.
"I guess that's the answer. We're screwed."
I pocketed the ball.
"Great."
Link started down the sunlit path without another thought.
"Where are you going?"
"No offense, but unless you have some kind of secret wayward clue about where to go, I'm not going down there."
He looked back at the darker path.
"The way I see it, we're lost no matter what, right?"
"Pretty much."
"Or if you look at it the other way, we've got a 50-50 chance of getting things right half the time."
I didn't try to correct his math.
"So I figure we take our chances on Oz and tell ourselves things are finally looking up. 'Cause what do we have to lose?"
It was hard to argue with Link's twisted logic when he tried to be logical.
"Got a better idea?"
Liv shook her head. "Shockingly, no. We headed for Oz." The tunnel really was right out of a page of one of my mom's tattered old L. Frank Baum books. Willows stretched over the dusty path, and the underground sky was open and endless and blue. The scene was calm, which had the opposite effect on me. I was used to the shadows. This path seemed too idyllic.
I expected a Vex to fly down over the hills in the distance any second.